The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Well, I'm delighted to be joined by one of the very few British footballers to have won the Ballon d'Or, which is the most prestigious award for footballers in Europe. Indeed, when he won it in 2001, he was the first player to win it since Kevin Keegan did in the 1970s. Michael Owen, thank you very much for joining us. I'm sure there are probably a lot of people thinking if there was an ex-Real Madrid and England footballer, it would be David Beckham who's won it, but you won it. Do you ever get enough credit, you think, in England for actually that achievement?
Well, I'm not sure, really. Thanks for the introduction. It's always nice to be introduced as a Ballon d'Or winner. It was a special moment, special winning it. I think it's grown more special as well the longer life has gone on, because there's no question about it. I didn't appreciate what it was and how big an award it was at the time. I was very young and I was in a rush. You know, I had this obsession about scoring goals, about winning trophies, and as soon as I won one, it was right, get it out my face. I want to win the next one type of attitude. And I remember getting presented with the award at Anfield, and it was almost embarrassing. You know, I was almost thinking, everybody's looking at me, I'm having to smile, and of course I'm happy to win it, but come on, let's quickly get this over with. Let's usher everyone off the pitch so we can just get on with the game, you know. And I was so focused on playing well again and scoring and all the rest of it.
But was that not a good attitude to have?
It's a great attitude to have. I think it is. I mean, it's the only attitude to have if you're going to be successful, because, you know, those people that do something good in their life and then spend a month or two, you know, patting themselves on the back and, you know, going and parading it to everyone and things like that, that, you know, probably there's been more to achieve in the meantime. So I think you've got to have that greedy attitude, so to speak. And it's certainly the one to have. But, you know, it was sometimes I do wish I'd taken a bit of a step back and just appreciated it more at the time.
It's interesting, though, that you would mention that at the outset of the interview. And you're here because you have brought out your second autobiography, Reboot, which some people are saying is much more open and honest, perhaps, than the first book, now that you've retired from the game. But I'm interested that you say that. I mean, how do you agree? Because your career probably then, and would it be fair to say, petered out a little bit because of injuries, which must have made it more difficult if you had that hunger and desire in the early part of your career.
Yeah, very difficult. I think I try to explain it as good as I can in the book. It was mental torture is probably a bit too extreme, but you know where I'm getting at. It was hard, you know, that having that mindset, let's say, that made me reach the top. And then still believing it as I'm sort of, as you put it, sort of fizzled away in a way, and I'm still sort of believing it, but almost kidding myself that I am still at the top of my game and that I can run past anybody. And really, you know, it took me a good while to come to that realization that you're not as good anymore. And the pain, the mental pain of that was hard to take.
Which is very interesting, because at one stage you would say about how when you were playing at Manchester United that you were coming towards ball to take the passes rather than looking to get in behind the defenders, utilising the speed that you used to have. And that was a complete different change in your game. You still had the touch. You still knew where you wanted to be. You still had the goal-scoring ability if you got the shot in the penalty area. But that fundamental change to your game must have been quite upsetting. That's quite limiting to you.
It is, and that's exactly, I mean, you've put it perfectly well. I couldn't... Football is about instinct. My instinct was always, well, whoever gets the ball in a certain situation, you instinctively know what to do next. And if a great player, say a Paul Scholes or something, towards the end of my career, got the ball, instinct told me, right, burst into that open space, you know, make a run to get in behind. But then a split second later, my brain would be saying, no, you can't. You're exposing yourself to an injury. If you gallop into that, you know, area of grass, if you do a 30, 40 metre sprint, you'll probably pull your hamstring or hurt yourself. And that's the pain of the last few years. I could still finish. I still had a good touch, but the speed was going. And all of a sudden, I just had to redefine my game. I had to be a link player come goal scorer. So show to feet, link the play. As soon as, you know, I'm not needed coming to feet anymore, go and get in the box and just use your instinct to score goals.
But you were able to do that. But maybe the problem was that people didn't expect that from you, that they expect you to continue playing in the way that you had burst onto the scene. That's something that made you different to other players.
Yeah, I mean, part of me is very proud of still, you know, despite the injuries and everything that was affecting me physically, to still be able to score goals at the highest level, you know, at 32 years of age at Manchester United. Part of me is pretty proud of that because, you know, as I say, I was virtually running on one leg at times. So to still be at that level, you know, knowing that I had, you know, so much more in me if I could physically do it was, as I say, something I am proud of. And every player has to change their game. You know, you watch Ryan Giggs when he first came, he was a left winger that you'd beaten everyone crossing the ball. I mean, when I joined Manchester, he was a centre midfield player, spraying the passing, you know, never on the left wing, beating players. Paul Scholes used to be a box to box, getting in late headers, goals. He ended up being a quarterback, you know, the football equivalent of a quarterback. Everybody does. It's just natural. We all get a bit older, slower, and you have to affect the game in different ways. But mine was pretty tough to deal with because it stripped me of my main asset.
But what I was really interested in is that it happened to you so young, because as I mentioned, you won the Ballon d'Or at the age of 21. By the age of 24, you're on the England team, you're the main man, and suddenly Wayne Rooney emerges at the European Championships. And again, it was fascinating how psychologically difficult it is for you to readjust, to realise that suddenly all the fame is going to this new kid who's just arrived.
Yeah, it's again, that's life. You know, I probably took over from Alan Shearer, and no matter what, when you hold that shirt, you always think it's a year or two early that you're passing it on. And, you know, I was holding that sort of main striker's shirt for a few years, and of course, a few strikers came into the squad, but never really did I feel threatened with who was there. I always thought I was, to put it bluntly, better than them. But as soon as Wayne Rooney came on the scene and he started training with us, I thought, wow, this kid is the next kid on the block, so to speak. He's going to take my shirt, and then it's going to be Wayne Rooney and Michael Owen, as opposed to Michael Owen playing with, you know, someone else. And that happened quite early. I think, as you say, I was probably about 24 when it happened. And I managed to stay in the team for a good few years later. Me and Wayne had a good run together. But, you know, it always hurts a little bit when you feel as if you're playing a little bit second fiddle. But again, that's life. You know, everybody grows old and everybody, you know, has a successor.
What do you put the injuries down to? I mean, obviously things like a very serious knee injury, these things happen just... that's part of the nature of the sport. But other things like hamstring injuries, which robbed you of the speed, do you put that down to perhaps playing too much football too young or not conditioning properly? What do you attribute that problem to?
Well, if you ask Sir Alex Ferguson, he thinks I played a lot too young. I don't necessarily disagree with him, but all I would do and all I would say to counter that is that my dad was a professional footballer for 15, 16 years. He was absolutely rapid like I was. And you can't be so quick without having a fallout in many ways. It's almost like, you know, you look out the window and you won't see a car really breaking down, but you go to a Formula One track and it's a little bit, you know, the speed hurts, speed kills. It's known I'm pushing my body far faster and with a lot more force than, well, at the time, anyone else on the pitch. So I believe, and my dad had lots and lots of muscle injuries. I believe that it's genetic. I believe it's in the family. My brothers both played football, both suffered with muscle problems.
So what you were blessed with was also a curse in some respects.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't swap it because it gave me something that nobody else had, and which was a defining factor in many ways. But it also, you know, made me pay the price for being quick. And I hear the argument. I hear, you know, Sir Alex Ferguson always says, like, Liverpool weren't Manchester United at the time. You know, Manchester United had all these great young players coming through and he could coax them and, you know, rest them and do all these things because he still had some great players in the first team. Whereas Liverpool, they relied on me at that time and I had to play in every single game.
I'm glad you mentioned Liverpool because I'm sure there might be lots of Liverpool fans listening who'll be going mad that you've been mentioning Alex Ferguson and Manchester United because to many people, first and foremost, you remained a Liverpool player. Do you ever regret, I mean, I know going to Real Madrid is just, for most footballers, is a pinnacle, but Liverpoolers are up there as well. They may not necessarily have been at the time, but in retrospect, was it the right thing to do to move to Spanish football?
Well, I was a lad approaching my mid-20s, but I think I had a fair, you know, head on my shoulders at the time. I made the decision that I thought was right at the time, and I definitely have no regrets. I mean, I had a wonderful time in Spain. It was an experience that virtually every footballer would do with exactly the same. When Real Madrid come calling, it is just an opportunity of a lifetime. And in fact, a lot of people ask me, do you regret it? But I find it's quite the opposite in many ways. I think, you know, lots of people will regret never being asked. You know, I think, wow, I was asked to play for one of the biggest teams in the world. New life, new country, new teammates, fantastic players, that shirt, that stadium. It was just a one in a lifetime opportunity. And I could be sat here saying to you, do you know what, once upon a time I was asked, but I said no. I stayed at Liverpool. I started playing a little bit worse because my injury started taking, and I wasn't that same player, and the fans remember me as a great player, and then I started going off the boil and it turned sour. Or I could be saying all this sob story, but actually no, Liverpool saw me at my absolute best, and I, you know, had the opportunity to go and experience something else as well.
One of your predecessors as one of the great Liverpool strikers, of course, was Ian Rush, who went to Juventus, and he struggled at Juventus and he came back to Liverpool. And I think that's one of the things that's interesting in your book as well, that you, when you did go back to England, you went to Newcastle because Liverpool didn't really make a good enough bid to get you back, was it?
That's right, yeah. I mean, I blame Rushy for me going over to Madrid in many ways and not being able to get back, because, to be honest, I ummed and ahed for a long time before I went to Madrid, and the deciding factor in my brain, in my mind, was thinking, I convinced myself that, okay, I can always come back. I might never get the chance to go again. Then Real Madrid might never want me again. So this is the time if you're going to go. And, you know, I made sure I spoke to Rick Parry, who was the chief executive at Liverpool at the time, and sort of shook his hand and said, I'll be back, obviously, and hope that you want me back. And it was almost like an unwritten agreement that, yeah, once you've finished at Madrid, we'll have you back, so to speak. But of course, great plans and all the rest of it. Time moves on. Other players get signed. You know, no football team are going to wait for somebody. It's, you know, it's a tough world out there. It's dog eat dog. You've got to win games and have the best players. And unfortunately, when I was ready to come back, we couldn't do it. You know, I thought we were there. I mean, I'd met Rafa Benitez. We'd all signed and sealed virtually, agreed, personal terms, everything. I floated on air all the way back to Real Madrid, and, you know, thinking that I'll just be there a few days and then it'll all be done. And when the president knocked on my hotel room to tell me a bid had been accepted, I was thinking, this is going perfectly. And then he said it was from Newcastle for 16 million. And that's when I knew there was going to be problems ahead, because Liverpool, you know, were only willing to pay what they'd sold me for. And that was 8 million.
Michael Owen is our guest. His new book is called Reboot. I'm fascinated, though, by what happened when you decided to go to Newcastle, that there was almost like a committee meeting. They're the board of directors, that yourself and your wife and your parents and agent and others all sort of had a say and took a vote as to whether you should accept the deal or not. And you were actually in the minority against taking the transfer.
Well, I was sort of torn in a way. I wasn't sure. It was World Cup year. I needed to be playing. They just signed Rabino for big money, so he was obviously going to play. You know, they've obviously had the stars like Ronaldo and Raul and Morientes. So I was just weighing up thinking, am I going to play so much this season? It is a World Cup year. I do need to be playing. Added to that, my wife was desperate to come home. And, you know, the options at the time then were Newcastle or Real Madrid. So I was sort of angling towards staying. A lot of people were saying, you know, you should probably go and be playing regularly. And we almost came to a compromise whereby we thought, we'll ask Newcastle. Of course, they knew that I wanted to go to Liverpool. So we asked Newcastle, if I go, can we have a clause in my contract to go to Liverpool should they meet the specific sort of
buyout clauses, yeah.
Exactly. And they agreed to it. And that was sort of made up my mind, thinking, OK, well, I'll do a season at Newcastle and then hopefully get my dream move back to Liverpool. But again,
you got stuck there for about 5 years.
Then I
years.
Did my knee and then it never happened. Then Torres was signed. And of course, you know, it never happened. So that's fine. You know, I did my best at all times to get back to the club that I wanted to go to. The only sad thing is that no matter where I went after that, it was always going to be a club that wasn't my first choice, which that's fine as well. I'm content with that. I understand that. But And I understand a fan of a football team thinking we don't want to be second choice to anybody. But, you know, Newcastle had Alan Shearer that came because that was his team, you know.
Yeah, how many footballers actually really do go now to the stage to a team because they were boyhood fans or whatever, or have some sort of sentimental attachment for one period? It's a professional business. It's a life. Surely you go to the team where you can get paid best and have the best opportunity to fulfil your potential.
And that is the same in any walk of life, isn't it? I mean, if my brother gets promoted from one bank to another or one supermarket to another and, you know, he gets more money or he gets better living conditions or it's better for his family in terms of the locate or whatever it might be, everybody pats him on the back and says, congratulations, that's a great, you know, you've worked hard for that. You've gone up the ladder. You're doing well in your job. You know, it's great for everybody. If you do it in football, it's snarled upon. You get called mercenary. You get called disloyal. You get called everything. But yeah, we all just want to be the best.
The loyalty thing is fascinating, though, because the loyalty doesn't necessarily cut both ways. There will come a time as a player that you will be dumped by the club.
Absolutely. Oh, I've seen it too many times. Yeah, exactly. It's, and I say that in the book. I say, you know, I think I'd like to find a more loyal person than myself, actually. I mean, loyalty is what I see is, you know, I was always desperate. I was loyal to Liverpool. I wanted to go back. Of course, I made one decision that, you know, was to have a new experience. But I had the same agent for the whole of my career. I've had the same partner, girlfriend, stroke wife, since I was about 3 years old. I've had the same best mate since I was 3 years old. I mean, I had the same boot sponsor my whole career. I'm not one to, you know, jump from relationship to relationship. I'm very much a steady relationships man as opposed to doing that. So,
but I'm also fascinated by the fact that you did say that when you retired that you did struggle with retiring and it did cause problems in your relationship with your wife, which surprised me because if your career sort of wound down and you had become used to the disappointments of not playing regularly, of being a substitute, not hitting nights at early in your career, I might have thought that you would actually have almost been preparing for retirement and then not be so surprised by it when it actually came.
Yeah, I totally agree. I wasn't surprised by it because I was sort of almost winding down, semi-retired, so to speak, at Stoke. I didn't play much. So I come to the conclusion. So it wasn't, no one was telling me you're retiring, nobody wants you. I was telling myself I've had enough. So there was that did help me. But, and it's not all the time, but I found myself, you know, feeling a little bit worthless in a way. You know, you've always been seen as the, you know, a savior for a team or the go-to man to score a goal or whatever, and then waking up, you know, one day and not, you know, that you almost feel a bit worthless in a way. And of course you want to start your new life and do other things, but, and it wasn't there every day, but I would sometimes feel a little bit empty. So friendships, relationships, all the rest of it, you know, it's not always a smooth passage. I think the stats for players getting divorced after they retire is just astronomical in the year after. And so I read that with great interest, and I can see why, because it does play with your head. I mean, all my life I've kicked the ball around. All my life I've thought I'm the most, you know, lucky, important. You know, I felt like there's a purpose. I get up every morning. It's like fitness. It's thinking of what you're eating. It's going to bed at the right time. It's like every single, it wasn't a choice. It was a life. And then all of a sudden, no one's interested and it doesn't matter what you eat or drink or anything. And I think no matter how much you prepare for it, it still takes a little bit of time.
Michael, you mentioned about the number of players who divorce. Also, lots of them go bust because they're not able to manage their finances. I was fascinated to discover, though, that your mother was effectively running all your finances up until the age of 38.
Yeah, not quite 38, but yeah. Yeah, again, you know, my life has been unique, let's say. You know, when you're the Golden Boot winner at 17, when you come back from a World Cup at 18 and then win another Golden Boot at 18, that's not normal. You know, in fact, it's never happened before.
Yeah.
So I've got nowhere. Nobody knows what to say to me. Nobody. I've got no, I'm having to fend for myself in many ways in terms of the mental side of things. So at that point, you have to have good people around you. You have to, you know, have good family members. You have to have a good advisor. So at that point, I said to my advisor, right, listen, I need to concentrate solely on football. Mum, you do all the, you know, because I can, obviously, if you can't trust your mum, you can't trust anyone. Mum, you sort sort of my life out. He'll sort everything else out, whether it's deals that are coming in or anything, and I'll focus on football. That was almost the unwritten rule. Now, that was life, and it never changed. I mean, yes, I knew how to draw money out the bank. Yes, I knew how to use a credit card, but paying, you know, an electricity bill and things like that, my mum used to just take care of everything like that for me. And you know what? It is laughable, and people do say, oh, these footballers, they're pandered to and everything else, and I suppose they are in many ways, but some people will also say, well, fair play. You know, he's a very much a family man. If you can't trust your family, then you can't trust anybody. And my mum was part of the team for a long time, and we all loved it. It's only now I'm sort of she's weaning herself away, and I'm taking a bit more control.
You mentioned her as being part of a team. Just a few questions to finish off, maybe more rapid fire questions. What was your favourite team that you played on?
Well, it has to be Liverpool in the early days. I mean, the 2001 season was the best. I actually think I was probably a better player in the season before that and the season before that. But that 2001 season, winning 5 trophies in 1 year, has to be the most memorable.
What would be your favourite goal?
Because
I'd imagine a lot of people, without asking you to pick this one, would think of your fantastic goal for England against Argentina in the World Cup in 98.
Yeah, favourite individual goal, I would have to say that, because, I mean, I scored numerous other goals, but I still believe I could have scored most of them when I was 32, 33. It was impossible. At 27, I could have scored that goal that I scored when I was 18. I wasn't fearless anymore. You know, didn't have the physical capability of doing it. Looking back, looking at that goal, you know, it wasn't just a fluke. That was happening all the time. I was beating players, I was scoring, I was going on runs. That was Michael Owen at the time. But at 27, I looked at that player and just thought, wow, you are totally different player now. You just don't do those things anymore. You can't do those things anymore.
Best player you played with?
Zidane would be the most naturally gifted player I've ever played with. But if I was going into a game tomorrow and I needed to pick somebody alongside me, I'd go for Steven Gerrard.
And the best player you played against?
Well, it would have to be the Ronaldos or Messis of this world, wouldn't it?
I mean, defender. So who would have been the defender that you would have felt would be the best player up against you that you really felt you'd have done well to score a goal against?
Well, I always say there's some great centre-halves. I mean, Rio Ferdinand was just a Rolls-Royce. John Terry was unbelievably talented. But the one player that I hated playing against was Marcel Desailly. And I know it was the end of his career, but he was fast, he was strong, he was good on the ball. And I know it's a blast from the past. I only played against him a few times, but wow, he was tough to play against. He was a machine.
World Cup winner with France in 98, of course. Okay, Michael Owen, it has been fantastic meeting you. I could have asked you about loads and loads of other things that are in the book Reboot, which, as I said, is you're a bit more candid, perhaps, than you would have been with the first book, which was written when you were quite young.
Well, again, you know, I let my agent sort of run my life. He told me, right, we're signing for Pepsi here, we're signing for Lucozade there, we're doing Umbro here, we're writing a book here, and you just let it go. I'm just, you know, I'm focused on my football. But this was my decision. I wanted to write a book. I wanted to get it all off my chest, and I'm pretty proud with the result.
Great stuff. Michael Owen, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.